Hi everyone, thanks so much for joining me. Today's podcast is just a little advice podcast covering some of the absolute no-nos, the strictly do not do's of conducting investigations into allegations of workplace bullying. So this list is drawn from the mistakes we commonly see internal investigators making when they're navigating the minefield of procedural fairness and due process, while at the same time sort of juggling operational imperatives and disruption to the workplace and the inevitable emotional impact for those involved in these types of investigations. So we thought it was about time that we put together this list of do not do's for misconduct investigations, so that you can get some idea of some of the things that you really should be avoiding when you're conducting your investigations internally. So without further ado, here we go. The absolute no-nos for conducting misconduct investigations. All right, number one on the list, delaying starting an investigation. And delays in completing an investigation. So we've called this one unnecessary delays, because we recognize obviously that there are some reasons, some very good reasons, why investigations into bullying complaints in particular can't be actioned straight away. But what we're talking about here today are the unnecessary delays that we quite often see occurring that can really make a situation a lot worse and place the organization and those involved at great risk. So we're saying, you know, this is probably number one on the absolute no-nos when it comes to responding to complaints of workplace bullying or any complaints of workplace misconduct. There are lots of, as I said, lots of legitimate reasons that investigations can sometimes start well after a complaint is made. And some of those things are unavoidable, such as key people being away, key witnesses being unavailable, or the complainant or the respondent being off on work cover, sick leave, and deemed to be medically unfit to participate. That happens quite frequently. But the reality is that particularly when it comes to complaints of bullying and sexual harassment, which fall under the banner of health and safety and which pose a potential ongoing risk to the health and safety for every day that they are unresolved, the health and safety of those involved. We see the Fair Work Commission and the courts taking quite a dim view when employers don't have a good reason for delaying an investigation. So, for example, when we see a lot needing to get a resolution from the board for an investigation, obviously to get the funds approved for an investigation or for the time that needs to be taken for an investigation, and then, you know, waiting until the next scheduled board meeting, which may be a month or more away. So it's really not a good reason for delaying an investigation. Needing to get sign-off from a CEO who might be on leave is not a good enough reason to delay, unless the CEO is on some sort of expedition, I suppose, in the Arctic Circle and can't be reached. But, you know, in that case, there should be somebody in the organisation with the CEO's delegated authority while the CEO is away. So if your organisation policy requires board approval for the appointment of, say, an external investigator, then the best thing to do is call an extraordinary board meeting to get the ball rolling and get on the phone to whoever has delegated authority while the CEO is away. And look, if there is no delegated authority for launching an investigation in the absence of, the key people, the executives, then, you know, I think it's important to probably create something for your organisation to cater for situations like that. Being too busy with other projects, not a good reason to delay an investigation, but this is a very common reason. Many investigations are significantly delayed. People just don't have the time and other projects are given priority. My advice there is if you're just too busy with other important projects to dedicate the time for an internally run investigation, then an external investigation specialist should be brought in. No doubt about it. Costs need to be considered and it can be a costly exercise. But at the end of the day, in the long run, it could save you hundreds of thousands in damages claims, work cover premium increases, and You know, you've also got to consider the general loss of productivity as these sorts of matters fester, and, you know, the potential for these matters to escalate is really high when there is no perceived action being taken by the organisation after a complaint is made. So what we need to make sure of is that any delays that are occurring as a result of factors that are perhaps outside of your control, we need to be making sure that we're transparent about those. And we need to make sure that those delays are justifiable. If you're standing in front of the, you know, the commissioner, and you're, or in front of a judge, and you are trying to explain the reason why this investigation has taken 12 months, for example, you know, can you justify it? The fact that, I guess complaints aren't sometimes, or the delays in actioning complaints aren't sometimes justifiable, you know, is a big reason why the Commission sometimes finds against organisations in terms of, you know, stop bullying orders and those sorts of things, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. Delays can also sort of cause complainants to speculate that their complaint has been ignored, it's gone unactioned. You know, if there's no transparency around why the delay is occurring, quite often people will just assume that, you know, their complaint has gone into some sort of black hole and never to be retrieved. And that can be really demoralising for people, and can result in people deciding to take further action through work cover claims, going off on stress leave, or, you know, the option is there, obviously, for them to lodge a stop bullying claim with the Fair Work Commission if they feel that, you know, their complaint hasn't been responded to or actioned. They have a right to do that. And that's a very public sphere to be in, and it's not a place that you want to be in as a business. In some situations, we've seen inaction lead to resignations, and in some extreme cases, we've seen mass walkouts because there might be a number of aggrieved staff who are waiting for the complaint to be dealt with, and if they feel they've been ignored, they walk out. Simple as that. I mean, if things get bad enough, people will do this. So unexplained delays or lengthy periods where there's no communication about the complaint can certainly increase mistrust for the organisation. It can result in some of the things that I've just discussed, mass walkouts, resignations, Fair Work complaints, those sorts of things. And a lot of people will start to believe that maybe the organisation is protecting the person they've complained against or is siding with them. And that's the last thing you want, because you want them to be able to trust the process. And if they think that the process is already biased from the outset, they're certainly not going to accept any outcomes that don't go the way that they think they should. And of course, when we're talking about workplace bullying or sexual harassment or any kind of misconduct like that in the workplace, delays can also lead to more incidents. Certainly if the person is engaging in the behaviour that they've been accused of engaging in, the likelihood is they're going to engage in further behaviour if there is nothing done about it. So even if, you know, I guess in a lot of cases what we find as well is when somebody has been is aggrieved in some way, they feel that they've been victimized in some way previously, they view every interaction with that person through the lens of victimhood, and it does tend to make them hypersensitive and read into certain situations that may be completely innocent. They may read into it that they've been further victimized, or they might be attaching some meaning to what might be a very innocuous and innocent sort of you know, action or statement. So that's what that's what sort of tends to happen, because it's human nature and it's a perfectly normal reaction to having been victimized by somebody, to view that everything that person does in the future through a suspicious lens. So the longer these things are allowed to go on, the greater the chance that there will be further allegations that you'll need to address, which will, you know, obviously create more work for you in the long run. And create more distress for the person who feels aggrieved. Now, investigations, no matter how sensitively they're conducted, they always have an emotional toll on those involved. So, you know, lengthy delays can increase the emotional toll as people are sort of left in limbo waiting for a resolution. And that's on both sides. That's not just the complainant, but also the respondent as well. If they're aware of the complaint, you know, they're feeling very vulnerable. They're feeling, you know, that their job may be in jeopardy. And it's a terrible place to be for a long period of time. And we need to consider this, and we need to consider the impact on people psychologically and emotionally over time for being left in limbo. And then, of course, there's the impact on the evidence. There's no doubt that the best time to investigate any sort of misconduct is right after it has happened. So the same can be said for any kind of, you know, a crime in the workplace or a crime anywhere. The police prefer fresh evidence than that evidence that is aged over time. And we the reason for that is that the more time that passes, the more difficult it becomes to collect reliable evidence. You know, memories fade, you know, emails are lost, CCTV footage is overridden. You know, all of those sorts of things can really affect the reliability of the evidence that you may need to collect to substantiate the claims. So the same can be said, obviously, you know, we've been talking about taking a long time to start an investigation, but the same can also be said once you started the investigation, taking an unreasonably long time to finish the investigation and wrap it up. Obviously, the longer you delay the findings, the greater the chance of some of these other negative impacts that I've already mentioned occurring. So it's also important that once you start the investigation, that you make sure that it's wrapped up in a reasonable amount of time. You know, really, the average workplace investigation, unless it's massively complex, should take no longer than 1 or 2 months to complete. And during that time, the parties should be given regular updates on progress and expected timeframes so that they can see some light at the end of the tunnel. And, you know, it's difficult because a lot of people, if they've never been through an investigation before, they have no idea what's involved. They think it could be wrapped up in a week. So they're disappointed when they find out that, no, actually, this is going to take several weeks. But what you need to explain, obviously, is that, you know, there's a certain process that needs to be followed for fairness on both sides. And that you want to be thorough and make sure that all the that no stone is unturned, is left unturned, and that's going to benefit both parties to the complaint. But we must always keep in mind that investigations or the knowledge of an investigation in the workplace can be really stressful, not just complaint for the complainants and the subject officers, but also, you know, for their colleagues and people who are called to assist, like with information, like the witnesses. So letting an investigation drag on for months can really cause, you know, stress for those people as well. And any kind of stress prolonged in the workplace can result in mental health issues, as we all know, anxiety problems, and it can really affect the cohesiveness and productivity of the whole team. No matter how sensitively and how confidentially you try to manage an investigation, the fact of the matter is it will impact people who are involved, and it will impact people who are on the periphery as well. So we need to make sure that once an investigation starts, that it's not dragging on for months and months and months. Now, when you're a manager or an HR officer and it's your job to investigate, it can be really hard. I understand that. You know, it can be hard to find the time to get it done, along with all your other mountain of duties. I mean, you know, it's a huge task. It's a huge job. So that's why it's really important to sort of plan your approach and prioritize the investigation as far as possible. And if you have to delegate some of your other tasks temporarily, then do it. You know, seek support from your higher ups so that you don't feel torn between working on the investigation and getting the rest of your job done. I mean, the bottom line here is he or she who hesitates is lost. So get cracking. Number two, not standing the subject officer down. Now, in my experience, a lot of employers are pretty resistant to standing someone down pending the outcome of an investigation. Now, this is usually for sort of one of two reasons. They worry, or both, they worry about the potential gossip and stigma attached to what we call gardening leave, or they cringe at the impact the person's absence from the workplace can have operationally. A lot of the time people are in key positions, and sort of putting them on unscheduled paid leave for several weeks might seem like an impossibility from an operational perspective. But the question I put to my clients in these situations is, are you serious about getting to the bottom of what's really happening in the workplace? Are you willing to risk the health and safety of your staff in return for maintaining productivity? And what impact could that person's continued presence in the workplace have on the complainant and also on the accused person if they are to come into regular contact with one another during the next few weeks while the investigation is underway? I've done hundreds of investigations over the years and I've never seen that scenario turn out well. It's fraught with risk, and for the following reasons. Firstly, continued interaction between the accused and their accuser can result in further accusations or conflict. The mental health of one or both of the parties can suffer. Witnesses can be intimidated and evidence can be tampered with in some situations. Don't ever rule that out as a possibility. I mean, when someone's job is on the line, you can understand that they might go to quite a length to make sure that anything that looks incriminating isn't around anymore. Witnesses can be reluctant to say what they know for fear of retribution when the accused person is still in the workplace. So when you're conducting an investigation that relies on people being candid and honest about what they've seen or heard, having the accused person out of the workplace can give people that sort of emotional space they need to speak out if something is untoward, if something untoward is going on. There's nothing worse for someone than being asked to rat on your boss and then having to walk into a meeting with the boss straight afterwards. So it can be a really intimidating scenario for people. And that intimidation is removed if the person is stood down while the investigation is underway. Now, you may not have to put the person on paid leave if there's a way you can have them work from home or have them on other duties at a different work site, perhaps, where they won't be coming into contact with the complainant or potential witnesses. And this can sometimes be a good compromise as far as keeping the parties separated that won't impact on productivity to the same extent if that's a major concern. And if you're worried about the person's reputation suffering as a result of being sent on leave, there's no reason that every person in the organization has to know what's going on. You can do this very discreetly. Staff don't they don't have a right to know why someone has gone on leave, so there's no need to tell them anything except that John Smith is taking some leave. Obviously anyone called as a witness in the investigation will be putting two and two together, but those people will be bound by confidentiality and they would have knowledge of the investigation anyway, whether or not the person was sent on leave. So the impact on reputation would be the same regardless, really, for anybody involved in the investigation. Keep that in mind when you are concerned about how standing someone down might affect their reputation in the long term. Number three, pressuring the complainant to take leave. Now, this brings me to my next point, I suppose, as far as talking about someone being stood down. Sometimes it might seem easier to send the complainant off on leave rather than to insist that the subject officer is stood down. But you could be letting yourself in for a world of hurt if you take this road. Now, before I explain why this isn't a good idea, I should mention that in some circumstances, standing or making the complainant go on leave or having the complainant go on leave, I should say, can work well if the complainant is already indicating they would rather be on leave. And that happens a lot of the time. The complainant will lodge their complaint and then they'll immediately go on stress leave. And this might be for a number of reasons. It may be that they've just reached the point where they can no longer be at work emotionally and mentally. They've got to the breaking point, in which case stress leave is warranted. But some employees are obviously very reticent about what might happen as far as retaliation or being treated differently in the workplace. while an investigation is underway, and that might be a very daunting prospect for them. So they may take leave, sick leave, or annual leave even, to avoid being in the workplace and having to rub shoulders with people who are involved in the investigation. And in those situations, obviously, you know, there's nothing wrong with allowing the complainant to take leave in that circumstance. I think it's probably wise, though, in that circumstance to, you know, put them on a type of gardening leave which won't affect their annual leave entitlements and the sick leave entitlements necessarily. If someone has genuinely been victimised in the workplace, they shouldn't be penalised for going on leave while an investigation is underway. Similarly, you know, you wouldn't expect a subject officer who was stood down to be taking annual leave or using up their sick leave entitlement while they're stood down. Similarly, if a complainant is, you know, offering to go on leave to alleviate stress for themselves while the investigation is underway, that should be fully paid and it shouldn't impact on their annual leave entitlement or their sick leave entitlement. Now, conversely though, if the complainant is showing no signs of wanting to take time off and their preference is to stay at work, then pressuring them or directing them to go on leave pending the outcome of their complaint is an absolute no-no. There's one reason and one reason alone that you should never insist an aggrieved employee is sent on leave, and that's a thing called adverse action. So a complainant who doesn't want to be the one forced out of the workplace could really see this sort of action as further victimization and possibly retaliation for making a complaint. And obviously, as you know, anything like that is unlawful under the Fair Work Act. The Act states that it's unlawful to take adverse action against an employee for exercising a workplace right. So making a complaint of bullying or harassment is exercising a workplace right. So we shouldn't be doing anything that could be perceived as retaliation, or we shouldn't be disadvantaging that person in any way for, you know, as a result of making that complaint. Regardless of whether you think the accused person is innocent of the allegations, the onus is on the employer to create a safe workspace. So your decision making needs to hinge on this and needs to manage the risk, which may mean standing the subject person down pending the outcome of an investigation. And this brings me to my next point. Number four, don't force the complainant to discuss their complaint directly with the accused person. So most grievance procedures will say something like, if you're having a problem with someone you work with, the first step is to approach that person directly and try to resolve your issues. And yes, you would expect that two employees having a disagreement should, as adults, be able to discuss it and come to a resolution. But in bullying cases or cases where there's a power imbalance between manager and report, it's not always that simple. Workers might be intimidated by the person, or they might fear that the bullying will escalate if they raise it with the alleged perpetrator. In bullying cases, the accused person is often the complainant's direct supervisor. And in these cases, it might seem logical to insist that the grievance procedure is followed. You might reason that the subject officer will be able to address the complaint directly with the complainant without the need for a formal investigation. After all, I mean, you know, this person, you know, may be responsible for managing the complainant day to day as their supervisor. So you might reason that they're used to addressing issues between staff. So maybe they can smooth things over and make any further action unnecessary. Wrong. You know, once a complaint is made, whether it's formally in writing or informally, the person about whom the complaint is made, the person to whom the complaint is made, I should say, is responsible for either escalating the complaint to someone more able to investigate or managing the complaint themselves. So handing the complaint back to the accused person to resolve is pretty irresponsible, and it's pretty fraught with danger. You need to assume that if a person has come to you with a complaint, they've done that for a reason. They may have tried to approach the accused person at some point in the past. You don't know what their history is necessarily, and you certainly wouldn't be expecting them to deal directly with the accused person if they've come to you. They've come to you for a reason. Quite frequently, complaint managers are skeptical about complaints because they haven't personally experienced the accused person behaving in the way that is being alleged. We see this so much in bullying cases in particular, because it's common for the bully's higher ups to be oblivious to the bullying. And this is because by nature, bullies often do a thing called managing up, meaning they present an entirely different persona to their managers than they do to those who report to them. It's almost like a Jekyll and Hyde scenario. So bullies can often be very charming when they need to be, butter wouldn't melt in their mouths, they're very good performers. But meanwhile, behind the scenes, they're an absolute tyrant. And you may think, I've been in HR for years and years, I've seen it all, I'm a good judge of character, I could pick a bully if I met one. Well, don't be so sure. As I said, bullies are great at managing up and they can often be very charming when they need to be. So don't assume, don't make judgments around whether a complaint is justified or not, because there may be a lot that you don't know. And we see this time and again with the investigations that we do. Our clients will often come to us going, look, we really think there's no substance to this. It doesn't make sense. But once we actually start looking into it, we uncover a Pandora's box of really bad behavior, not just towards the complainant. Often there are other victims, often in the workplace as well. So that's why it's important sort of to be open to the fact that a complaint about Tim from middle management, for example, might be genuine, even though you've never experienced Tim as anything but a great guy. So those reporting to Tim, you have to understand, might be seeing an entirely different side to him. So once again, going back to allowing Tim to address the complaint directly, that could cause the complainant to feel further victimized and could cause tremendous stress and anxiety for that person. So it could also leave the complainant open to actual intimidation and pressure to withdraw their complaint. So that's why it's vital that when a complaint is made, you take steps to mitigate the potential for possible future harm, even if you think that there is no substance to the complaint. And this may mean, as we mentioned earlier, standing the accused person down or taking steps to prevent the accused person from coming into contact with the complainant until the matter can be investigated and resolved. The number one rule is, once the accused person is notified of the complaint, they must be read the Riot Act about not discussing the complaint with anyone except perhaps their union delegate, their legal rep, or their support person, and whoever's managing the complaint in that organisation, which may be you. So I've seen subject officers sort of openly mocking complainants to other employees within earshot of the complainant, mocking the complaint, saying things to colleagues like, Sarah says I'm intimidating, are you scared of me too? So this sort of behaviour alone should constitute instant disciplinary action, but so often in my work I see this sort of behaviour being allowed to happen. All right, last but not least, point number 5, don't pressure the complainant to mediate. Mediation has its place, and I've seen plenty of high conflict situations where mediation has worked really well in getting people to see things from another point of view and find a way to work together moving forward. But, and this is a big but, mediation is rarely a panacea where workplace bullying is a factor. Now, this is because by its very nature, bullying involves intimidation and fear. So when one person is fearful of another person, finding mutual ground is near impossible. Where there's a power imbalance between the accused person and the complainant, and bullying is a factor, a mutual resolution is all but impossible. The complainant will always feel vulnerable. And having to come to face to face with their superior officer and explain their grievances and then have those grievances minimized or argued against or even lied about can be really traumatic. Mediation also leaves the door open for further bullying. So while a good mediator obviously isn't going to allow any disrespectful behavior that might be overt, they may not always pick up on the more subtle acts of intimidation, such as body language or facial expressions, things like eye rolling. And then there's also veiled threats. Now, veiled threats by nature are not overt threats. And so quite often they can go under the radar in a mediation session. The mediator won't understand the context. They won't understand the background to the extent that they would be able to pick up on veiled threats. So a mediation can, in a bullying scenario, can leave the victim feeling further victimized. So I'd strongly warn against it when bullying is part of the allegation. However, you know, if you've conducted a thorough investigation and you've determined that no bullying has taken place and you're pretty certain of that, and that really it's simply a matter of a personality conflict or a communication failure, then, yeah, of course, mediation can be a really good resolution. But if the conflict is long-standing and involves communication difficulties and poor conflict resolution skills, then what I would suggest in that scenario is for one or both parties to be given some coaching before they mediate so that these sorts of issues can be worked on and the mediation has a greater chance of success. So one example I have of this is where through our investigation process, a manager was found to have had a bit of a habit of passive aggressive behavior when he became frustrated. So we identified that mediation was an option for resolving his conflict issues with his direct supervisor. But before we could get them into that mediation, we had to deal with the worker's passive-aggressive tendencies. So through some intensive coaching, we were able to get him to a place where he could recognize his behavior patterns, acknowledge these passive-aggressive behaviors were contributing to the conflict, and give him the tools to deal with his frustration in a more sort of mature and productive way. And then he was then able to go into mediation and work productively with his supervisor to resolve their differences. So, you know, it was actually a really worthwhile exercise doing mediation. But before we could really have a successful mediation, we had to deal with some of these personality issues that were standing as a barrier, if you will, to successful conflict resolution. So there you have it, folks. 5 absolute no-nos when conducting workplace bullying investigations. Now, I could go on and on. This is by no means an exhaustive list. I could come up with probably 100 no-nos, but that would be a very long podcast. Obviously, there are lots of pitfalls when managing these sorts of matters. And certainly we see time and again matters that make it to the Fair Work Commission are matters not where the employer necessarily is unjustified in taking action against an employee, but where the process has, you know, let them down. The way that they've managed the investigation, the way that they've managed the parties to the complaint, that's where they've been let down. In my next podcast, I'm going to be talking about some of the process-related no-nos when conducting investigations. So this is an area where a lot of employers fall down and end up with unfair dismissal findings made against them, which is often very public shaming and an expensive exercise for organizations. So watch out for that one coming soon. Thanks for listening, folks. If you'd like to comment on this podcast or send us ideas for future podcasts, you can message us on Facebook or write to us at admin@synergywi.com.au. That's it for now, guys. Thanks for joining me.